Psychotherapy and Existentialism, selected papers on logotherapy. The subject of this sound seminar is Self-Transcendence, the Motivational Theory of Logotherapy. Here is Dr. Frankel.
There are two specifically human phenomena by which human existence is characterized. The first is constituted by man's capacity for self-detachment. Another capacity of man is that for self-transcendence. In fact, it is a constitutive characteristic of being human that it always points and is directed to something other than itself. It is therefore a severe and grave misinterpretation of man to deal with him as if he were a closed system. Actually, being human profoundly means to be open to the world, a world that is which is replete,
Maslow,
with other beings to encounter,
has air
and
similar
meanings to fulfill.
And in a more recent study,
this self-transcending quality of human existence is ignored and neglected by those motivational theories which are based on the homeostasis principle. According to these theories, man is basically concerned with maintaining or restoring an inner equilibrium, and to this end, with reducing tension. In the final analysis, this is also assumed to be the goal of the gratification of drives and the satisfaction of needs. As Charlotte Buhler has rightly pointed out, quote, from Freud's earliest formulations of the pleasure principle to the latest present version of the discharge of tension and homeostasis principle, the unchanging end goal of all activity, all through life, was conceived of as the re-establishment of the individual's equilibrium, unquote. The pleasure principle, as we see, serves the purpose of the homeostasis principle, but also in turn, the purpose of the pleasure principle is served by something, and that is the reality principle. According to Freud's statement, the goal of the reality principle is to secure pleasure, albeit delayed. Allport objected to the homeostasis theory and said that, quote, it falls short of representing the nature of appropriate striving, whose characteristic feature is its resistance to equilibrium. Tension is maintained rather than reduced, unquote. Maslow, as well as Charlotte Buhler, has aired similar objections. And in a more recent study, Buhler stated, quote, that according to Freud's homeostasis principle, the ultimate goal was to obtain that kind of full gratification which would restore the individual's equilibrium in bringing all his desires to rest. From this point of view, all cultural creations of humanity become actually byproducts of the drive for personal satisfaction, unquote. But even with a view to future reformulations of the psychoanalytic theory, Charlotte Buhler is doubtful because, as she says, quote, the psychoanalytic theory can, in spite of all attempts to renew it, never get away from its basic hypothesis that the primary end goal of all striving is homeostatic satisfaction. Creating values and accomplishing things are secondary goals, due to the overcoming of the id by the ego and superego. But again, ultimately, serving satisfaction, unquote. In contrast, Buhler conceives of man, quote, as living with intentionality, which means as living with purpose. The purpose is to give meaning to life. The individual wants to create values. Even more, the human being has a primary or native orientation in the direction of creating of values, unquote. Now, with specific reference to the pleasure principle, my own criticism goes even further. For it is my contention that in the final analysis, the pleasure principle is self-defeating. The more one aims at pleasure, the more his aim is missed. In other words, the very pursuit of happiness is what thwarts it. And this self-defeating quality of pleasure-seeking accounts for many sexual neuroses. Both orgasm and potency are impaired by being made the target of intention. This occurs all the more if, as is frequently the case, excessive intention is associated with excessive attention. Hyper-intention and hyper-reflection, as I'm used to calling them, are likely to create neurotic patterns of behavior. The more one intends to gain pleasure, the less he will obtain it. This is due to the fact that pleasure, rather than being a goal itself, is and must remain a side effect or a byproduct of attaining a goal. Attaining a goal, as one could say as well, is the reason why I am happy. And if I have a reason to be happy, I need not care for pleasure and happiness. I need not pursue them. They ensue automatically and spontaneously, as it were. And this is why it is not necessary to pursue happiness. But why is it not even possible to pursue it? Because to the extent to which one makes happiness the objective of his motivation and thus the object of his attention, he loses sight of the reason for happiness. And consequently, happiness itself must fade away. Now, the accent which Freudian psychology places upon the pleasure principle is paralleled by the emphasis which Adlerian psychology places upon the status drive. However, this striving also proves to be self-defeating. Insofar as a person who displays and exhibits his status drive will sooner or later be dismissed as a status seeker. In the final analysis, the status drive or the will to power on one hand, and the pleasure principle or, as one might term it, the will to pleasure on the other hand, are mere derivatives of man's primary concern, and that is his will to meaning, as I call this basic striving of man, to find and fulfill meaning and purpose. It turns out that pleasure, rather than being an end of man's striving, actually is the effect of meaning fulfillment. And power, rather than being an end in itself, actually is the means to an end. As much as if man is to live out and exert his will to meaning, a certain amount of power, say economic or financial power, by and large, will be an indispensable prerequisite. Now, only if one's original concern with meaning fulfillment is frustrated, is one either content with power or intent on pleasure. The assumption of a will to meaning is quite compatible with Charlotte Wohler's four basic tendencies. For also according to her theory, fulfillment is the final goal, and the four basic tendencies secure and serve the goal of fulfillment. However, I would like to clarify that what is meant by fulfillment is the fulfillment of meaning rather than fulfillment of the self or self-actualization. Self-actualization is not man's ultimate destination, not even his primary intention. Self-actualization, if made an end in itself, contradicts the self-transcendent quality of human existence. Also, self-actualization is and must remain an effect, namely the effect of meaning fulfillment. Only to the extent to which man fulfills the meaning out there in the world does he fulfill himself. Conversely, if he sets out to actualize himself rather than fulfill a meaning, self-actualization would immediately lose its justification. This is perfectly in accordance with Maslow's own view, since he admits himself, for instance, that the business of self-actualization can best be carried out via a commitment to an important job. Elsewhere, I have discussed this and some of the following issues in a more elaborate manner. Here, let me only add that excessive concern with self-actualization may be traced to a frustration of the will to meaning. As the boomerang comes back to the hunter who has thrown it, only if it has missed its target. In the same way, man also returns to himself, reflects upon himself, and is intent upon self-actualization only if he has missed his mission and if his search for meaning is frustrated. If we take it for granted that fulfillment, more specifically, meaning fulfillment, is the final goal of human life, it may well be that various tendencies are not only simultaneously conducive to this goal, as is the case with Charlotte Wohler's four basic tendencies, but also successively, that is to say, in successive stages of development. In the same vein, it would be justified to assume, as Aaron J. Angersmer does, that the Freudian pleasure principle is the guiding principle of the small child. The Adlerian power principle is that of the adolescent. And the will to meaning is the guiding principle of the mature adult. Thus, Angersmer says, quote, "The development of the three schools of Viennese psychotherapy may be seen to mirror the ontogenetic development of the individual from childhood to maturity," unquote. However, the main reason for stipulating such a sequence would be that in the earliest stages of development, there is no indication of a will to meaning. But this fact is no longer embarrassing as soon as we recognize that life is a Zeitgestalt, a time gestalt, and as such becomes something whole only after the life course has been completed. A certain phenomenon may therefore form a constitutive aspect of humanness and yet manifest itself only in an advanced stage of development. Let us consider another definitely human capacity, that of creating and using symbols. There is no doubt that it is a characteristic of humanness. Although there is no one who has ever seen a newborn baby with the command of language. Now, as to an empirical corroboration of the will to meaning concept, James C. Clambeau and Leonard T. Mihalik state, quote, "The trend of observational and experimental data is favorable to the existence of Frankl's hypothetical drive in man," unquote. This, however, brings up the question whether it is legitimate to speak of the will to meaning in terms of a drive in man. As for myself, I should negate it, for if we saw in the will to meaning just another drive or need, man would again be seen as a being basically concerned with his inner equilibrium. Obviously, he would then fulfill meaning in order to satisfy a drive to meaning or need for meaning, that is to say, in order to restore his inner equilibrium. In any event, he would then fulfill meaning not for its own sake, but rather for his own sake. But even apart from subscribing to the homeostatic principle, conceiving of man's primary concern in terms of a drive would be an inaccurate description of the actual state of affairs, in that an unbiased observation of what goes on in man whenever he is oriented toward meaning would reveal the fundamental difference between being driven to something on the one hand and striving for something on the other hand. It is one of the immediate data of life experience that man is pushed by drive, but pulled by meaning. And this implies that it is always up to him to decide whether or not he wishes to fulfill meaning. Thus, meaning fulfillment always implies decision-making. From this, it can be seen that the sole reason why I speak of a will to meaning is to preclude a misinterpretation of the concept in terms of a drive to meaning. By no means is a voluntaristic bias involved in the terminology. It is true that Rollo May has argued that, quote, "The existential approach puts decision and will back into the center of the picture, and after the existential psychotherapists are concerned with the problems of will and decision as central to the process of therapy, the very stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner," unquote. But I should like to add that we have also to take heed lest we relapse into preaching willpower. Will cannot be demanded, commanded, or ordered. One cannot will to will. And if the will to meaning is to be elicited, meaning itself has to be elucidated. What is true of pleasure and happiness also holds for peak experiences in the sense of Maslow's concept. They too are and must remain effects. They too ensue and cannot be pursued. It is Maslow's contention that hunting peaks is a little like hunting happiness. Even more, he concedes that the word peak experiences is a generalization. However, this is still an understatement of the part of Maslow, because his concept is more than a generalization. In a way, it is even an oversimplification. And the same holds for another concept, the pleasure principle. After all, pleasure is the same irrespective of what causes it, and happiness is the same irrespective of the reason to experience it. Again, it is Maslow who admits that our inner experiences of happiness are very similar no matter what stimulates them. And as to the peak experiences, he makes a parallel statement to the effect that they are uniform, although, quote, the stimuli are very different. We get them from rock and roll, drug addiction, and alcohol. Yet the subjective experience tends to be similar, unquote. It is obvious that dealing with the uniform forms of experiences, rather than with their different contents, presupposes that the self-transcendent quality of human existence has been shut out in the first place. However, at every moment, as Allport puts it, man's mind is directed by some intention. Also, Spiegelberg refers to intention as the property of an act which points to an object. He leans on Brentano's contention that every psychical phenomenon is characterized by the reference to a content, the directedness toward an object. But also Maslow is aware of this intentional quality of human experience, as is evidenced by his statement that, quote, there is in the real world no such thing as blushing without something to blush about. In other words, blushing always means blushing in a context, unquote. Now, from this, we may see how important it is in psychology to view phenomena in a context. More specifically, to view phenomena such as pleasure, happiness, and peak experiences in the context with their respective objects. That is to say, with the reason a person has to be happy, and the reason he has to experience peaks and pleasures, as the case may be. Conversely, cutting off the objects to which such experiences refer must eventuate in an impoverishment of psychology. That is why human behavior cannot be fully understood along the lines of the hypothesis that man cares for pleasure and happiness irrespective of the reason to experience them. Such a motivational theory brackets the reasons, which are different from each other, in favor of the effect, which is the same in each and every case. Actually, however, man does not care for pleasure and happiness as such, but rather for that which causes these effects, be it the fulfillment of a personal meaning or the encounter with a human being. This is most noticeable in the case of unhappiness. Let us imagine that an individual is mourning the death of a beloved person and is offered some tablets of a tranquilizing drug in order to bring him relief from his depression. Except for the case of neurotic escapism, we may be sure that he will refuse to tranquilize his grief away, for he will argue that this would not change anything. The beloved would not be revived this way. In other words, the reason for being depressed would remain. And unless he is a neurotic individual, he will in the first place be concerned with the reason for his depression rather than the removal of this depression. He will be realistic enough to know that closing one's eyes before an event does not do away with the event itself. And I think the scientist should be at least as realistic as man normally is and explore the behavior of man in the context of its intentional reference.